Welcome. Hi, I'm Pat.
And hi, I'm Jesse, and you are tuned in to The Deep Dive.
Today, we're taking a deep dive into the truly fascinating world of therapy. It's often misunderstood, actually.
Mm-hmm.
It's a field with this incredibly rich, complex history. And, you know, it's evolved so much from its earliest forms, some quite surprising, to the diverse and accessible practices we see today.
That's right. And our mission for you, our listener, is really to unpack not just what therapy is, but maybe more importantly, how it actually works.
Yeah, how it functions.
Exactly. And where it came from, its origins. Because understanding that whole journey, that long, winding road, can genuinely help you make more informed decisions about mental health.
For yourself, for others.
Right. We're going to try and cut through some of the noise, you know, the information overload out there, and bring you the most important insights. And honestly, some really surprising facts from the sources we've looked at.
Okay, so let's unpack this. To really get started, maybe we should challenge a common idea. When we talk about therapy, it feels so modern, doesn't it? Like something from the last 100 years or so.
It does, yeah.
But people have actually been helping each other through talking, through different wellness practices, meditation, for centuries, maybe even back to ancient Greece.
Absolutely true. Yeah. That need for comfort, for understanding, guidance, it's always been there. But here's where it gets really interesting, I think.
Mm.
The official term, psychotherapy, the specific idea of a formal, dedicated mental health therapy, it only really emerged in the early 1800s, the 19th century.
Wow, that recent.
Yeah. What's fascinating is that while people always sought solace, the concept of psychotherapy as this recognized thing, it's barely 2 centuries old. That fast evolution from, you know, spiritual beliefs to a more scientific understanding, it's not just a timeline. It's a huge shift in how we even think about the mind.
It really is remarkable how recent that formalization is, especially given, like you said, the need has always been there.
Mm-hmm.
And before psychotherapy became this structured thing, the past, well, particularly for people struggling with mental health, it was pretty bleak.
Yeah, bleak is putting it mildly sometimes.
These conditions were often seen as what? Curses, possessions, sometimes labeled hysteria. And that term, female hysteria, tragically, it stuck around, leading to awful misdiagnoses and treatments for women.
Yeah.
Well into the late 20th century, even.
It's sobering, isn't it, how long some of these ideas persisted. Before the 1800s, if you were just different from the norm, you could sadly even be called a witch.
Unbelievable.
And the early treatments, truly inhumane. The first U.S. mental health hospital opened in 1752. Practices like purging, bloodletting, severe isolation, they were common.
And patients were sometimes watched for entertainment. That's just chilling.
It really is. Yeah. Chilling to think about now.
It puts the progress we've made into such sharp perspective. And these terms, these practices, it's so important to say they're now rightly seen as offensive, totally obsolete. It really shows how much the field has grown up.
Exactly. And the good news is, by the 1800s, things did start to shift. Slowly but surely. Institutions began adopting psychotherapy, moving away from those, well, barbaric methods.
Okay, so a turning point.
A huge step was when Leitner Whitmer opened the first psychological clinic. That was 1896.
Right.
And that was a turning point because professionals started diagnosing conditions based on observation, on scientific thinking, directly replacing those old harmful ideas about supernatural causes.
That sounds like a massive leap forward.
Mm-hmm.
But, what were the limitations, even with this sort of newer, more humane approach starting?
Well, yeah, even then, therapy wasn't nearly as inclusive as we think of it today. It was often pretty religious, frequently rooted in Christian faith and access, mostly for wealthy white men and their families. Women, LGBTQIA plus individuals, BIPOC communities, they often faced mistreatment or got very unprofessional care if they could get any care at all.
Hmm. That's a really critical piece of the history. Progress wasn't equal.
Definitely not. It highlights how progress, even when it's significant, is rarely universal straight away.
So when psychotherapy started becoming more of a practice in the 1800s, what did it actually look like? What kinds of therapies were gaining traction? How did they, you know, work?
Well, in those early days, the big ones were psychoanalysis and Jungian analysis, both focused on the unconscious mind, digging into the past.
Okay.
But you also had some, let's say, less scientific ones, like mesmerism. Using magnets.
Seriously.
Yep. Supposedly to relieve distress. And phrenology, studying the shape of the skull to figure out personality.
Wow. Okay. So a mixed bag.
A very mixed bag. Thankfully, those last two didn't really stick around in mainstream practice.
Right. And when we think talk therapy, the name that jumps out is Sigmund Freud, often called the father of modern psychotherapy.
Mm-hmm.
But what's the surprising origin of his version of talk therapy?
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Most people connect Freud just with adult analysis, but his first work with talk therapy back in the early 19th century was actually with children who had learning disabilities.
Really? Children first?
Uh-huh. And then his book, An Interpretation of Dreams, in 1900, that really helped bring his ideas into the mainstream, got people talking about the unconscious mind, how it affects us.
So if you were doing psychoanalysis back then, what was the actual process? How was it supposed to work for you as the client?
Okay, so psychoanalysis was what they called insight-oriented. The core idea, the mechanism for change, was helping the client gain insight by uncovering unconscious stuff.
Wow.
You'd talk, verbalize everything, thoughts, free associations, fantasies, dreams, often lying on a couch, analysts out of sight.
Right, the classic image.
Exactly. The analyst interprets all this to find hidden conflicts, past and present, that were thought to cause the symptoms or personality issues. The belief was, bring these hidden things into your conscious awareness, and that resolves them. Symptoms get better.
But it took a long time.
Oh, yeah. Typically a very long-term thing, often years.
Okay. And then moving into the 20th century, we see a really different approach emerge. Behaviorism.
Right, the behaviorist revolution.
Yeah. And behavioral therapists also started doing a kind of talk therapy, which eventually evolved into cognitive behavioral therapy, or CBT.
Indeed. CBT, thanks to people like Aaron Beck and Albert Ellis, became much shorter, more structured, very focused on the present.
So this raises a key question. How is it fundamentally different from psychoanalysis in how it helps? What's the mechanism?
It's a great question. Unlike psychoanalysis digging into the unconscious past, CBT focuses on identifying and directly changing your current unhelpful thinking patterns, your beliefs, how you interpret situations, and how you react.
More active, less interpretive.
Exactly. The mechanism for change is actively learning new cognitive skills, new behavioral skills to manage problems now, rather than just getting insight into why they started way back when.
And then another big shift with Carl Rogers. Humanistic therapy, starting around the 1950s. This sounds like a reaction against those earlier theories where the therapist was the expert, the one with all the answers.
Totally a reaction. Rogers really championed a different way, his client-centered therapy. It emphasizes that the client takes the lead, exploring their own feelings, their emotions.
In the therapist's role.
The therapist provides this really supportive, non-judgmental space, but crucially, they don't offer solutions or interpretations like in psychoanalysis. The whole approach highlights the individual's own ability to figure things out, to resolve their issues, to reach what Rogers called self-actualization.
So the mechanism for healing there is the client finding their own way.
Pretty much. Finding their own path and potential, but within this really deeply empathetic and authentic relationship with the therapist.
It feels like a total shift in the power dynamic. After decades of expert-driven approaches, Rogers is saying, you, the client, you hold the key. That must have been radical.
Oh, it was revolutionary. It shifted the focus entirely from the therapist as the authority to the client as the authority on their own experience. Rogers even called them clients, not patients, because he didn't see them as inherently wrong or sick.
That framing matters.
Huge difference. His core conditions for therapy to work, unconditional positive regard, basically genuine acceptance, congruence, meaning the therapist is authentic, real, and empathic understanding. They were all about creating this incredibly safe space for you to explore yourself and grow, mm-hmm. empowering the individual. That's the core mechanism.
Looking at therapy today, it's such a diverse landscape now. It feels like the field grew beyond just Freud and Rogers, recognizing that mental health isn't just the mind, right? It's our whole being.
Exactly. That holistic shift really spurred new things like body psychotherapy, somatic therapy. These approaches really integrate the body's experience. And then you have highly specialized things like EMDR, that's rapid eye movement, desensitization and reprocessing, and exposure response therapy, ERP.
Right. So modern therapy, it feels much more client-led often and takes this broader view.
Yeah, very often client-led, and definitely holistic. Therapists now look at so many factors. Family mental health history, trauma, past experiences, relationships, habits, behaviors, feelings, even things like how you respond to imagery or sensory input.
So the way it works now often involves integrating all these different parts of a person's life and experience.
Precisely. Recognizing that the mind and body are just deeply connected, that's often key to the mechanism of change now.
If you zoom out, the implication is just such a more complete view than, you know, bloodletting or thinking someone's possessed. It's a whole different world.
It truly is. And there's real science behind this shift. Scientists now know, for instance, that certain mental health conditions can actually show up differently on an MRI scan.
Wow.
Yeah. Or the brain can react differently to stimuli based on past experiences. These medical studies really hammer home that mental health conditions are, well, more than a possession or spiritual experience, as people tragically believed centuries ago.
Okay, so this all sounds incredibly promising. Progress has been huge, but let's get right to it. Does therapy actually work? And how do we know?
Okay, the big question, and the answer is a pretty resounding yes. Therapy does work, and science absolutely backs this up. Studies consistently show that around 75% of people who go into treatment benefit from it. That's a huge majority.
75%. That's significant.
It really is. And some studies even suggest therapy can be more effective than medication alone for certain conditions. The mechanism for why it works is complex, but it involves learning new coping strategies, processing difficult emotions, gaining self-understanding, and crucially, having that supportive, objective professional guiding you.
That makes sense. And what about this term evidence-based therapy, EBT? What does that actually mean for someone listening, thinking about therapy?
That's a really important concept. EBT means that healthcare providers use knowledge from solid, rigorous research to figure out the most effective treatments for specific problems.
So it's not just guesswork.
Not at all. It includes determining the best type of therapy for a particular mental health challenge, and even things like the optimal number of sessions. It's about using what science shows us actually works, moving beyond just anecdotes.
Okay, so it's data-driven. Can you give us some examples of common EBT methods people might have heard of and sort of how they function? What's the mechanism?
Sure. We mentioned cognitive behavioral therapy, CBT, earlier.
Yeah.
That's a prime example of EBT, especially good for depression and anxiety. It works by helping you spot and change those unhelpful thought patterns and related behaviors.
Right.
Then there's dialectical behavioral therapy, DBT, often used for borderline personality disorder. It's not just about thoughts. It actively teaches concrete skills, things like mindfulness, how to tolerate distress, regulate emotions, improve relationships. Really practical tools.
Okay, very skill-based.
Very skill-based. And for trauma, like PTSD, eye movement desensitization and reprocessing, EMDR, is a well-proven EBT. The theory there is that the guided eye movements help the brain reprocess and integrate traumatic memories so they're less distressing. It kind of unsticks them.
Fascinating how specific the mechanisms are for different approaches. So while the techniques vary a lot, what really stands out is how vital the therapist's communication seems to be. Explaining things clearly, letting the client be part of the decision-making. That feels critical to how it works.
It absolutely is. That therapeutic relationship or alliance between the client and therapist, it's consistently found to be crucial for success. Sometimes people argue it's even more important than the specific technique used.
Really? More than the technique?
In many cases, yes. It's the foundation. If you don't trust or connect with your therapist, it's hard for any technique to really land. And if you're thinking about that first session, yeah, it's totally normal to feel anxious, maybe awkward. Therapists are trained for that. They know how to create a safe space, gather info gently, make you feel comfortable. It's okay to say, hey, I'm feeling nervous about this.
Good to know. You can just say it.
Absolutely. And if you cry, that's what the space is for. There's no set schedule for feeling better. It might take a few sessions, maybe a month. To feel like things are clicking and that relationship is building, give it time.
That's really reassuring. Now, shifting gears into the 21st century technology.
Yeah.
It's changed everything, including therapy. We've seen this huge rise in online therapy.
Oh, absolutely. Online therapy has become super popular and way more accessible for many people.
How so?
Well, comfort, you're in your own space.
Although.
Often more cost effective. And you get access to this huge database of specialists you might not have locally. It really opens doors.
And does it work as well?
The research, yeah, overwhelmingly supports its effectiveness for lots of conditions. Anxiety, depression, PTSD. It's great news for access to care.
It really feels like a game changer for accessibility. Getting treatment from home, especially like getting to an office, is tough. But with thousands of mental health apps out there now, too, it also feels a bit like the Wild West, doesn't it?
It definitely does. Estimates are like 10,000 to 20,000 mental health apps available. Huge number.
Wow.
But here's the catch. A lot of them aren't based on those evidence-based methods we talked about. One review found only about 30% actually meet quality standards for being effective.
Only 30%? That's low.
It is. And maybe even more worrying, privacy concerns. Many popular apps have pretty significant issues with data privacy, sometimes even selling user data. often without people really realizing it.
Yikes. That raises a huge question for anyone listening. How do you even know if an app is reliable or safe with so many options floating around?
That's where the future of digital therapy gets really interesting and honestly quite hopeful. The solution emerging for this Wild West problem is the FDA stepping in. They now recognize software as a medical device. SAMD?
SAMD.
Yeah. And specifically, they're regulating something called Prescription Digital Therapeutics, or PDTs.
Prescription Digital Therapeutics. So like apps you need a prescription for.
Exactly. Think of them as medical-grade, highly regulated apps. PDTs are evidence-based, regulated software designed for specific medical purposes. Only a few have been FDA-approved so far, which shows how rigorous the standard is.
Can you give an example?
Sure. Resetto was approved back in 2018 for opioid use disorder. And just recently, March 2024, Rejoin got approved for major depressive disorder.
So the software itself is delivering the therapy. What's the mechanism?
Essentially, yes. The software delivers clinically proven therapeutic interventions directly to the user based on established EBT principles, like CBT.
Looking at the bigger picture, this sounds like a massive step for health equity, making standardized, cost-effective treatment available to way more people.
It really is. Treatment that might have been limited before because of cost or location, PDTs could make it much more accessible. It's incredibly exciting for the future of mental health care and how therapy can work for potentially millions more.
It is a huge step forward, making that evidence-based care standardized, regulated, often more affordable.
Yeah.
It really expands who can get effective help.
Widens the net considerably.
So we've really journeyed through the evolution of therapy today. From those ancient roots, the sometimes dark early practices, all the way to modern evidence-based digital solutions. And we've tried to explore how it actually helps people along the way.
Yeah, and we've touched on how different approaches work, insight from psychoanalysis, changing thoughts and behaviors in CBT, the client leading the way in humanistic therapy. We've seen this incredible shift from really archaic ideas to today's diverse, scientifically backed, and increasingly accessible methods, right up to these cutting-edge digital tools.
We really hope this deep dive has given you, our listener, a clearer picture, maybe sparked some aha moments about the power, the potential of therapy. We'd love for you to come back for our next deep dive.
Yeah, and if you enjoyed this, please do like, share, leave a comment, let us know what resonated with you.
And maybe a final thought to leave you with.
As we keep weaving technology and science deeper into mental health care, what new forms of therapy, of connection, of healing might be just around the corner, things we can barely even imagine today. It's a really exciting question to ponder. Thank you for joining us on The Deep Dive.
And we'll see you next time.
Goodbye.